Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with the discussion of the journalistic skewing of war coverage. In addition to discussing the deep-sixing of the Operation Tailwind story that April Oliver and Jack Smith did on CNN in the summer of 1998, we were, at the conclusion of our last half-hour segment, examining the fundamentally different accounts of Gulf War syndrome in two articles carried in two different editions of the same newspaper, namely the San Francisco Examiner of 4/15/1999. We began by looking at an AP story, Dateline San Diego, and headlined, Potential Gulf War Illness Panacea Tested. Subtitled, Study, Mysterious Ailment May Be Bacteria-Linked. This particular article deals with the research that has been conducted by Drs. Garth and Nancy Nicholson, a subject that we have dealt with on this program before. Garth and Nancy Nicholson had come across an apparently genetically modified bacterium called, or microorganism called, a mycoplasma that appears to account for a substantial portion of the Gulf War ailment that veterans of the Gulf War have been experiencing. The genetically engineered mycoplasma appears to have a gene from HIV spliced in it to make it much more pathogenic, i.e. disease-causing. And one of the controversies surrounding this is that, in the first place, that there are indications, as Dr. Nicholson discussed, in not only a two-hour broadcast that featured Drs. Leonard Horowitz, Alan Cantwell, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and also Ed Haslam, this on the subject of genetic engineering and biological warfare. In that two-hour discussion, which was excerpted into a pair of half-hour segments dealing with Gulf War syndrome, Dr. Nicholson opined that the Iraqis had obtained this particular genetically engineered mycoplasma from the United States as part of the transfer of weaponry to Iraq, and that they apparently had utilized this in munitions that were fired at some of the GIs, and that this then has brought the ailment back to the United States. The discussion of the use of doxycycline to successfully treat the mycoplasma was the main focal point of the article in the one-star edition. But then the later four-star edition carried another article about Gulf War syndrome, also an AP story occupying exactly the same place in the newspaper, the left-hand column of page A2, and occupying exactly the same amount of space vertically, but with a fundamentally different focal point. The focal point of the four-star edition was the possibility of chemical exposures and also exposure to depleted uranium. This is an AP story by Laura Myers, Dateline Washington, headlined, U.S. GIs in Gulf not hit by toxics. And skipping down in the story, we're going to resume where we left off in our last half-hour segment. Upon reviewing all available evidence, our investigators determined that the exposure of U.S. armed forces in the area must be assessed as unlikely, unquote. This is the possibility of exposure to nuclear, biological, or chemical agents. Continuing, this is from Bernard Rosker, a defense official in charge of Gulf War syndrome issues. His last name, Rosker. At the same time, Rosker said that the Pentagon couldn't rule out the possibility of chemical warfare agents being present as the evidence was not complete. One of two Fox vehicle tapes is missing, and the soil samples may have been packaged incorrectly, he said. The Pentagon hasn't completed a final report of the cement factory findings, he said. In another report that reviewed several RAND studies, the Pentagon found no evidence of harmful health effects directly linked to exposure of troops to depleted uranium in the Gulf War. No increased levels of cancer or other illnesses have been detected among Gulf War veterans compared with other populations, said the report, which notes the body is very effective at eliminating ingested and inhaled uranium. Exposure to uranium at high doses can cause kidney problems, but no increase in kidney disease has been observed among Gulf War veterans, the report said. Researchers at the VA Medical Center in Baltimore are following a group of Gulf War veterans with the greatest exposure to depleted uranium, including some with embedded fragments from shrapnel. Although the veterans have an array of health problems related to their combat injuries, the researchers said, quote, to date, no manifestations of kidney disease attributable to the chemical toxicity of depleted uranium have been found, unquote. No radiation illness was discovered either researchers said. Now, again, this is an AP story occupying exactly the same amount of space in exactly the same place in two different editions of the same newspaper. Again, the San Francisco Examiner of 4/15/99, and yet there is no mention whatsoever in the later four-star edition of the genetically engineered mycoplasma or the trials of doxycycline or Dr. Garth Nicholson's research whatsoever. Again, this by way of indicating that we need to examine the coverage of not only news in general, but war news in particular, with a great deal of circumspection, and take what is said by officialdom on all sides with a generous dose of salt. There's also been considerable distortion of the facts concerning the conflicts that have erupted in what used to be Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Research credit on the following article goes to a member of the listening audience who researched this for us from Covert Action Quarterly's issue of Fall of 1998. This concerns a piece of disinformation which circulated around the world and which did much to create sympathy for armed intervention by NATO and others in the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. This is an article entitled Misinformation, TV Coverage of a Bosnian Camp. It's by Thomas Deichmann, D-E-I-C-H-M-A-N-N, a freelance journalist in Germany and co-editor of the German magazine Novo. In August of 1992, media coverage of the Bosnian War gained unprecedented influence on decision-making processes in the West. Reports about horrifying conditions in camps run by the Bosnian Serbs galvanized world opinion. The visit to the camps at Omarska and Tronopli by a British team from Independent Television News, or ITN, on August 5, 1992, gave rise to the image of the Serbs as the new Nazis of the Balkans. The picture of an emaciated Muslim behind barbed wire, taken in Trnopli, and that's T-R-N-O-P-O-L-J-E, I'm probably mispronouncing that, taken in Trnopli camp by ITN, and first broadcast on August 6th, was seen as proof of the existence of Nazi-style concentration camps run by Bosnian Serbs. The media coverage of Bosnian camps fueled the rapid escalation of the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. From July 1992 onward, comparisons of the civil war in Bosnia to the Nazi past was the key message of many Western media reports. At the end of July, the then leader of the Bosnian Serbs, Radovan Karadzic, had agreed to permit a team of British journalists to visit the camps in Bosnia. Shortly after this invitation, Penny Marshall and Ian Williams from ITN and Ed Vuljami, V-U-L-L-I-A-M-Y, from The Guardian arrived in the war zone. Their visit to the camp at Omarska was an oppressive experience and also a disappointment. Marshall and Williams were annoyed because, despite Karadzic's promises, they were not allowed to enter all of the buildings. After a dispute with the authorities, they departed for the last stop on their trip. Trnopli, located only a few miles away and directly adjacent to the small town of Kozorak. In May of 1992, Kozorak had been taken by Serbian units, many Muslim inhabitants had been killed, and many more driven out, seeking refuge in the Trnopli schoolhouse, the nearby community center, and the open area behind both buildings. In Trnopli, the ITN reporters shot the pictures that were destined to have worldwide impact. The most significant was that of an emaciated Muslim, Fikret Alic, A-L-I-C, in a group of Muslims under the blazing sun, bare-chested, behind a barbed wire fence. The impact of this image on world opinion was profound because the symbolic link, the impact of this image on world opinion was profound because of the symbolic link with Nazi concentration camps. Marshall and Williams were the first to supply a suitable illustration for the comparisons to the Nazi past. The image of Alic behind barbed wire was reproduced worldwide in virtually every significant medium. It has become the, quote, proof, unquote, of the existence of concentration camps in Bosnia 50 years after the end of the Third Reich. Marshall and Williams did not call Trnopli a concentration camp, and both have expressed reservations about the way the images were interpreted. Ian Williams voiced his concern in an interview with the British Press Gazette only a month after his visit to Trnopli. Quote, in a sense, it's almost the power of the images going two steps ahead of the proof that went with them, unquote. Ed Vuljami's first article on Omarska and Trnopli was published in the British Guardian on August 7th, 1992. He did not mention the barbed wire fence in Ternopil at all, and he stated that Ternopil should not be called a concentration camp. But regardless of what the British reporters said at the time, the image of Alich behind barbed wire told its own story. The proof, unquote, was the banner headline over the picture as published on August 7th by the Daily Mail. Belsen 92 was how the Daily Mirror captioned the photograph the same day. In the United States, ABC News introduced its August 6th news item about the Bosnian camps with the comment, quote, "Faces and bodies that hinted atrocities of the past. But this is not history. This is Bosnia. Pictures from the camps. A glimpse into genocide," unquote. There were only a few critical comments on the disclosures of the British reporters. Phil Davison, a foreign correspondent who covered the war from both sides for the British Daily Independent, explained, quote, "Things had gone slightly quiet. Suddenly we had death camps, we had concentration camp stories, we had direct comparisons with the Second World War. I felt at that stage that there was an exaggeration," unquote. U.S. politicians reacted as emotionally as the journalists. Tom Lantos, Democrat of California, a member of the House Foreign Relations Committee, said in an interview for Channel 4 on August 6th, quote, "I very much hope that those horrendous pictures, which are reminiscent of the Nazi concentration camps that the Nazis had during World War II, minus the gas chambers, will stir public opinion both in Europe and the United States," unquote. The broadcast of ITN's images led to a rapid response from international politicians at different levels. In an article entitled, "How Media Misinformation Led to Bosnian Intervention," George Kenney, K-E-N-N-E-Y, who resigned as the Yugoslav desk officer at the U.S. State Department in August of 1992, gave his personal account of how the interpretations that the world placed upon ITN's pictures of the Ternopil camp helped Washington move to a war footing. Kenney wrote, quote, "The first turning point that led straight away to the introduction of Western troops coincided with ITN's broadcast of images of what was widely assumed to be a concentration camp at the Bosnian Serb-run Ternopil Refugee Collection Center in August of 1992," unquote. Kenney also noted that a wave of sanctions against the Bosnian Serbs from international organizations up to and including the threat of military attack was the direct result of ITN's coverage. Aroused by the barbed wire picture, on August 18th, the British government decided to make 1,800 British soldiers available for peacemaking areas for peacemaking in the area of conflict. In the U.S., presidential candidate Bill Clinton took the initiative in his campaign, making constant references to the ITN pictures and requesting military action against the Serbs. In Brussels, a NATO staff of advisors met on August 6th for an emergency meeting to speed up the planning of a military intervention in the Balkans. The ITN image of the barbed wire was to become a great influence on the later work of the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. In the final report of the Commission of Experts, which was completed in the summer of 1994 to provide conclusions regarding the evidence of violations of humanitarian laws committed in the former Yugoslavia, the barbed wire in Ternopil was mentioned several times. In the first trial of the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague against the Bosnian Serb Dusko Tadic, which lasted from August to October of 1996, the barbed wire fence and the famous ITN shot played a prominent role. Tadic was accused by an anonymous witness known only as L of participating in numerous atrocities in Ternopil camp, where L said he had worked as a guard with Tadic and participated in the atrocities. During his testimony, L, who had been brought to the tribunal from a Bosnian prison in Sarajevo, made a drawing to show how the barbed wire fence allegedly enclosed the entire camp area. ITN rushes were presented to the court as further evidence for the prosecution. Tadic's defense lawyer, Professor Misha Vladmirov, who suspected L of lying, confronted him out of court. In the presence of a court official, L broke down and admitted that he had made the entire story up. The official reported to the judges, and all parties agreed his testimony would be withdrawn and disregarded. Nevertheless, Tadic was convicted of charges unrelated to Ternopil, and the subliminal power of L's map and the ITN images survived unscathed. After the trial, Vladimirov met with L, now identified as Dragan Opacic, O-P-A-C-I-C, who confessed that he had never worked at Ternopil, but that he had been forced by the police in Sarajevo, who threatened to kill him and his whole family, to testify against Tadic. By the way, Tadic is T-A-D-I-C. They showed him videotapes of Ternopil to bolster his credibility. Among them were the ITN pictures of the barbed wire fence. The ITN coverage is a striking example of how quickly media reports can influence international diplomacy and military planning. Penny Marshall's barbed wire picture was certainly not the only reason for a new dynamism in the initiatives of Western governments, but it triggered an avalanche which brought others down with it. In a unique situation in the summer of 1992, two trends converged. On the one hand, there was a general crisis of Western international diplomacy resulting from the end of the Cold War. The U.S. establishment in particular was confronted with the fact that its dominant role, based on institutional and political arrangements instituted after the Second World War, was called into question. The Bosnian War started in a period in which there were more uncertainties and competing ideas about the future of America's role in international relations than there were clear and consensual values. On the other hand, a number of journalists were dissatisfied with the indecisiveness of their governments. They sensed a lack of purpose and a vacuum in international diplomacy and felt the need to intervene in this process. The notion that journalists should have a stronger obligation to put pressure on their own governments to make political and military decisions found a clear expression in discussions of the Bosnian War. In the introduction to a book on media coverage of the war, the editor stated, quote, "The conflicts in Bosnia focused frustration at the limits of international diplomatic action. Although the media rarely affected decisions, it sometimes placed those in the policy field under great pressure. In the absence of a clear and strong international, particularly Western policy that there had been over the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, policy was characterized by indecision and a lack of cohesion." Unquote, by the way. Some journalists explicitly redefined their jobs as one of morally and politically legitimizing more Western military intervention as the only solution. To a certain extent, they tried to fill a vacuum in international diplomacy. To what extent and why the ITN pictures had such an impact on decision-makers in Western governments was discussed by media experts. Even many who would argue that governments in general are resilient in the face of intense media pressure and do not alter policy to meet the demands of the press, a view that is shared by this author, argued that the ITN broadcast was an exceptional instance in which policy indeed was changed as a result of media reports. The editors of Bosnia by Television concluded with reference to research done by Nick Gowing, G-O-W-I-N-G, that, quote, "The most significant example of this was the ITN reporting on Bosnian Serb concentration camps in the summer of 1992, unquote. Gowing summarized the reactions of Western leaders as policy panic, unquote, a view shared by George Kenney, who wrote about State Department public affairs officials being in a, quote, nuclear panic, unquote. From the beginning, there were a few journalists and officials who warned about negative consequences resulting from the dynamic created by the ITN reports. Nick Gowing noted that the ITN broadcast was not seen by everybody as having a positive result for the Bosnian Muslims. He referred to humanitarian organizations who voiced the criticism that the pressure of ITN's reports actually furthered Serbian ends because refugees were moved out of camps and out of Bosnia. The International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, observed that, because of the international excitement generated by the ITN reports, every chance had been lost to attain a solution enabling the Muslims to stay in the region. 4.5 years later, I discovered that ITN's coverage was not as accurate as suggested. The central image of the barbed wire in Ternopil, what British newspapers called Belsen 92, was misleading. The fact is that Alić and the other men in the famous picture were not encircled by a barbed wire fence. There was no barbed wire fence surrounding the Ternopil refugee and transit camp. The barbed wire was only around a small compound next to the camp, which had been erected before the war to protect agricultural products and machinery from thieves, and which the journalists had entered. Penny Marshall and her team got their famous pictures by filming the camp and the Bosnian Muslims from inside this compound, shooting through the compound fence at people who were actually standing outside the area fenced in with barbed wire. It was almost by accident that I discovered this. Professor Vladmirov was the first to tell me that he did not believe the barbed wire fence encircled the entire camp at Ternopil. A few years later, my wife and I were looking at the picture when she observed that the barbed wire appeared to be nailed from the inside, the prisoner's side, which I knew from having worked as a gardener was not the usual practice. I then began intensive research, studied the ITN outtakes, visited Ternopil, and interviewed former guards and civilians from the area. The unedited ITN rushes I obtained show clearly from where the famous shot was taken. Also, the tribunal in The Hague and the ICRC confirmed that there was no barbed wire around the camp. Ultimately, ITN admitted that there had been no barbed wire around the Ternopil camp. In March of 1997, ITN solicitors read a statement to the British High Court saying that ITN's reports, quote, did not describe the camp as ringed with barbed wire, unquote. An analysis of the role played by the famous ITN image raises several questions of concern for the media. The crucial piece of evidence allegedly supporting the assumption that Nazi-style concentration camps were maintained in Bosnia was entirely problematic. Nevertheless, the outcome of the developments in the summer of 1992 was that journalists felt that they had an unprecedented influence on politics and firmly believed that they had taken the high moral road. Some reporters got further lost in simplistic attempts to cover a complex civil war, blaming the Serbs for whatever happened. Veteran BBC war reporter Martin Bell, criticizing the media's approach to the, quote, siege, unquote, of Sarajevo, stated, quote, one thing these stories all had in common was that they tended to reinforce the stereotype of good Muslims and bad Serbs. Some reporters' sympathies were co-opted so openly that they started to refer to the Serbs in the language of the Bosnian presidency as, quote, aggressor forces, unquote. The Serbs' case, even if they had one, went unheard, unquote. Nick Gowing characterized some of the strongly anti-Serb reporting in Bosnia as, quote, a secret shame, unquote, for the journalism community. I think there is a cancer now affecting journalism. I think it is the unspoken issue of partiality and bias in foreign reporting, unquote. Gowing's statement, as well as the hostile reactions by some colleagues to my revelations, refer to a trend in which journalists take sides and adopt a moral mission rather than doing their traditional job as war reporters. By the way, I would add that same kind of coverage was characterized the O.J. Simpson case. Continuing. In a time of uncertainty and lack of direction, journalists were seeking new moral absolutes and arguments to put their own governments under pressure to intervene in the Balkans. In an interview, Peter Hanke, a well-known Austrian writer, was asked why he believed that he had become the target of a witch hunt by leading European intellectuals and newspapers after publishing a travelogue of the former Yugoslavia in early 1996, which questioned the way that the Serbian people had been demonized in discussions of the Balkan War. The author replied, quote, I don't like to theorize or politicize, but Serbia was probably what corresponded to the inner emptiness of many people who otherwise no longer have any commitment, any passion, or above all, any vision. The artificially created aggressor Serbia and the tunnel vision it produced then came along and filled the emptiness, unquote. This trend has brought forth a new code of conduct regarding what can and cannot be said. The moral agenda of journalists has created an orthodoxy that no one is allowed to challenge. If you do so, you not only risk becoming a target of smear campaigns, you are silenced. Gowing noted, quote, there is something rather taboo or even heretic to talk about this in media circles, unquote. There is also, it seems, a far greater willingness to take legal action against critics of the consensus. By the way, I would add that in our first half-hour segment, we talked about the deep-sixing of April Oliver's Tailwind story. She has since then been sued by some of the special operations group people that helped stage those operations in Southeast Asia. Continuing. There is also, it seems, a far greater willingness to take legal action against critics of the consensus. This is what happened in Britain. ITN's response to the publication of my article, The Picture That Fooled the World, in LM Magazine in February of 1997, was to sue the editor, the publisher, and the magazine for libel. The article had been published in various versions in four countries, including prestigious newspapers like Weltwoche in Switzerland and The Standard in Austria, well before it came out in Britain. But only in the UK was there a legal basis for a libel writ, not against the German author, but against the English magazine. ITN used the repressive British libel laws to hinder an important discussion for the media profession. Whereas in many other countries the subject was widely discussed in a controversial but mainly constructive fashion, in Britain, the risk of being sued by ITN stopped several journalists from covering the story. Articles that did appear were often only part of a smear campaign against the author and the magazine. ITN has become the subject of some criticism, however. Harold Evans, former editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, stated that, quote, "It is a shame that it, ITN, did not choose to seek redress against living Marxism in a television confrontation, rather than by issuing writs and apparently silencing discussion of a complex situation." I guess LM stands for Living Marxism here. That's the name of the magazine. Continuing. Additionally, an open letter signed by prominent journalists and academics, including Noam Chomsky and Philip Knightley, appeared in the UK Press Gazette and The Spectator, encouraging all, quote, "all journalists to support LM against the libel writ and defend a free press and open debate," unquote. Knightley further called it a, quote, "case of historical importance. A win for ITN will be a blow to free speech," unquote. The publishers of LM have launched an appeal in defense of free speech, unquote, which has won support from many prominent individuals such as Doris Lessing and William Boyd. Even Martin Bell, who had been attacked by LM editor Mick Hume for his concept of a journalism of attachment, concluded, quote, "I think it was wrong of ITN to take LM to court. I have often been libeled, but never sued. I think it is wrong for journalists to do so." An international campaign to support LM and press freedom was also started in Germany. Hundreds of individuals have signed an appeal launched by individuals like the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, the head of the German Union for Journalists, Detlef Henschke, the general secretary of the West German PEN, Johanno Strasser, and the veteran think tank of the Social Democratic Party, Peter Glatz. Despite the mounting criticism, ITN raised the stakes in July of 1997 and accused LM of express malice, a charge which takes the case further away from an investigation of the factual evidence and carries the threat of punitive damages if accepted by the court. LM's legal coordinator, Helen Searles, warned that this latest ITN move represents an ominous new use of libel laws to impose yet further restrictions on free speech. Quote, "ITN wants to punish LM to pursue LM for having a bad attitude," unquote. It seems ironic that ITN, which has promoted its own human rights achievements, is prepared to silence its critics on the basis of English libel laws, which, according to a recent U.S. court ruling, quote, "fail to measure up to basic human rights standards and are repugnant to public policy and the constitutional ideal of free speech," unquote. Hopefully, the implications of the questions related to ITN's barbed wire pictures from Ternopil can soon be examined in full detail and openly debated without fear of being sued, even in the United Kingdom. And again, I'm probably mispronouncing Ternopil, T-R-N-O-P-O-L-J-E. This again from Covert Action Quarterly, number 65 from the fall of 1998. The various tapes that I've produced are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.